The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter of December 2020. And I'm going to start off by concluding an article I started previously about face mask discomfort. This was a series of questions about face masks and what to do about them. The next question was, what do I do if it irritates my skin? Facial rashes or breakouts from mask wearing are common, says Dr. Jason Frangos, a dermatologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He points to several potential causes. Masks can trap oils, irritants, and allergens against the skin and block hair follicles and glands, causing pimples. In other cases, some people have a form of dandruff that affects the face called seborrheic dermatitis. This is a red, scaly rash that may be worsened by heat and humidity that builds up beneath the mask. What can you do? Wash cloth masks regularly. You should also wash your face regularly and consider an over-the-counter acne wash that contains salicylic acid to help unclog your pores. For seborrheic dermatitis, wash your hair daily with an anti-dandruff shampoo and keep oil off the face with a gentle cleanser, Dr. Frangos suggests. The straps hurt my ears. A mask's ear loops can make your ears sore. Elastic straps pull on your ears and put pressure on your skin, which can become irritated. For irritated skin, a steroid cream and moisturizer can help, Dr. Frangos says. There is also gadgets that can relieve pressure on your ears. One is called an ear saver, a strap or clip that attaches to the ear loops and is worn behind the head. Make your own version by threading a shoelace through the ear loops and tying it behind your head. You can also find headbands and ball caps with large buttons placed so you can hook the mask ear loops onto them. Other options are masks with fabric ear loops, which may cut down on irritation, and masks with fabric straps that you tie behind your head instead of loops you place around your ears. Under a subheading, what to look for in a cloth mask. Cloth masks come in many styles and fabrics. One of the most comfortable types is a neck gaiter, a fabric tube placed around your neck that you can pull up and down. But gaiters perform very poorly on tests to block viral particles. In other words, they just don't work. The most effective cloth masks are about the size of your hand and have straps that tie behind your head or loop around your ears. Some of these masks have a curved vertical seam in the center to make the mask bow out and give you room to breathe. Others have multiple horizontal folds that enable you to adjust the fit up and down easily. The construction you choose can affect your comfort. That preference will be specific to each individual. What should be the same for all cloth masks, according to the World Health Organization, is that they have three layers. The first layer, closest to your mouth and nose, should be made of cotton or another moisture-wicking fabric to absorb droplets from your exhaled breath. The middle layer should be made of polypropylene fabric, a non-woven material, the kind used in surgical masks, or a removable polypropylene filter. The outer layer should be made of a fabric that will repel moisture, like polyester or polyester cotton blend. If you overheat easily, look for inner and outer layers of tightly woven, lightweight, high-tech fabrics that can help you feel cool. Some sporting goods companies are selling these type of masks. Some mask makers claim their fabrics have antimicrobial properties, but there's no evidence they can protect you against COVID-19. Above all, make sure a mask covers your mouth and nose with no gaps on the sides. Going on with the Harvard Health letter, next comes Ask the Doctor with Dr. Anthony Komaroff, the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Health letter. How do I improve the quality of my sleep? Question: how many hours of sleep do I really need each night, and how do I improve the quality of my sleep? Adults need to average between 7 and 9 hours of sleep every night. If you're over 65, 8 hours is probably enough. The occasional short night of sleep won't hurt you. Your question about the quality of sleep is really important. The stage of sleep that brings the greatest benefits is deep sleep, also called slow wave sleep. It has that name because the electrical waves created by your brain become larger and less frequent. In other words, they're slow. During deep sleep, your heart rate and breathing slow down, and your muscles relax. You're also much harder to awaken, and when you do awake, you feel groggy and do poorly on brain tests for the next 30 minutes. It's called sleep inertia. 20% of your total sleep is spent in deep sleep. What is deep sleep good for? It's during deep sleep that your brain creates and stores new memories, makes a hormone that helps your tissues grow and regenerate, and flushes out toxins and waste products that have accumulated during the day. So getting enough deep sleep is really important. If you don't get enough deep sleep one night, your brain will compensate by giving you more the next night. This works fine unless you're regularly not getting enough sleep. The best way to ensure you get enough deep sleep is to get enough total sleep. Besides getting enough total sleep time, what else can you do to improve your amount of deep sleep? Dr. Komaroff has 8 recommendations. First, go to bed and get up at the same time 7 days a week. Keep the room as dark as possible. Don't use mobile phones or laptops for 30 to 60 minutes before going to bed. Avoid caffeine for 8 hours before going to bed. When you think about that, that means that if you go to bed at 10 p.m., you should avoid caffeine after 2 p.m. And you should avoid alcohol for 2 hours before bed. A nightcap may help you fall asleep, but it also reduces your time in deep sleep. You should engage in regular daytime exercise, but don't exercise right before you go to bed. Reduce carbohydrates and increase healthy fats in your diet. Warm your body in a bath or shower before bedtime. Consider using a noise machine while you sleep. Smartwatches and in similar exercise monitoring wrist devices are getting increasingly good at helping you know how much total and deep sleep you're getting. I recently got a smartwatch in part for this reason. We wouldn't be programmed to spend a third of our lives sleeping unless it was important for our health. Next is a really pertinent article, which is called Navigating Holiday Pressures in the COVID-19 Reality. Holiday pressures are always challenging, and maybe more so this year. Risk of COVID-19 exposure may have you worried about attending indoor gatherings and sharing a meal or a hug with loved ones. How can you deal with the pressure of deciding whether to accept or decline an invitation, and how do you cope with changes this holiday may bring? For advice, we turned to two faculty members from Harvard Medical School's Department of Psychiatry, David Topor and Patricia Bamonte. Both are clinical psychologists with the VA Boston Healthcare System. Question: how do I cope with the pressure to attend holiday events? Bamonte answers, talk about the risks and benefits with your doctor and with the loved ones who will be at the event. Keep an open dialogue so the pressure doesn't feel like this is just your decision, but a collective decision, so you'll feel supported by your loved ones. Question: what should I say if the holiday event seems risky? Topor: be an advocate for what you feel is needed to reduce risk, your risk, and the risk to others. Consult with your doctor and health agency guidelines and offer ways to reduce risk to make the gathering safer. Question: how do I decline an invitation without feeling awkward? Topor responds, write out a script ahead of time and practice it, or have an email ready to go. Keep it brief and stick to the facts. Say something like, I'm not going to in-person gatherings this year due to COVID-19. Then add some emotions. You'll miss the experience and you're sad about it. And suggest alternative ways to spend time together, like a video or phone call. If your doctor says you're at increased risk from COVID-19 because of various medical conditions, you can substitute, at my doctor's urging, I'm not going to in-person gatherings this year due to COVID-19. Question: how do I cope with the sadness of being separated from my loved ones? Bamonte: your personal values regarding protecting people's health guided your decision. Honor those values. Topor: it's healthy to grieve because something is lost, and losing contact with family and friends is a loss. How can I enjoy holidays alone? Bamonte: if you practice a religion, watch online religious services. Make holiday food and decorate. Put up things that are meaningful to you. Pull out a photo album or make a scrapbook of holidays past, or share a special recipe with your kids or grandkids. That could be another way to share a holiday tradition if you can't be there. Topor: another idea is to relive and really savor a past holiday experience. Watch a video and recall the smells and sounds. You can also imagine the next holiday and how good it will feel to celebrate in person with others. Bamonte says, also think of this holiday season as another occasion in your life when you'll need to face hardships and challenges. You've already proved that you're resilient. There's also a subheading that's entitled Maintaining Safety at Indoor Holiday Gatherings. As we reported last month, COVID-19 risks are high indoors, especially if the space is small, crowded, or poorly ventilated. If you spend a long time there, if people aren't wearing masks, or if you share a hug, you can reduce risk by taking these steps. Limit the gathering size depending on your local rules. For example, in Connecticut, indoor gatherings are capped at 25 people. Minnesota caps it at 10. The more people who attend a gathering, the more risk of COVID exposure. Keep windows open to improve ventilation. Avoid physical contact. Wear masks that cover the nose and mouth. Stay 6 feet away from people who don't live in your household, even at a dining table. Or abandon the table and set up chairs around a large room. Have only one person serve food. Wash hands using disposable towels before ending. Disinfect commonly touched surfaces like doorknobs and faucets. Limit the amount of time you spend at a gathering. There's no official number of minutes that increase risk. The longer you attend a gathering, the higher the risk. Keep a list of attendees to notify in case someone develops COVID. The next article is entitled Simple Solutions to Soothe Sore, Fragile Gums. Try over-the-counter medications, water flosses, and rinses. Gum pain's hard to ignore. The aching, stinging sensation can linger for days and make eating uncomfortable. If the pain's new, you may worry it signals an undiagnosed condition. As you search for answers, you can relieve pain with a number of home remedies and over-the-counter options. Sore gums have many potential causes. Often, they are reversible. They may be due to a stage of gum disease called gingivitis. It happens when a buildup of plaque irritates the gums, making them red, swollen, and prone to bleed easily. Sore gums can also be caused by too vigorous toothbrushing, irritation from dentures, mouth injury, burns from hot food, an infection at the base of a tooth, thrush, which is an overgrowth of the fungus Candida albicans, anemia, oral herpes, rare autoimmune skin conditions that cause blisters in the mouth, deficiency of a vitamin C or K, and the use of calcium channel blockers, which are prescribed to treat high blood pressure, chest pain, or an irregular heartbeat. Many of the causes of sore gums also make them fragile and prone to tearing easily. Some underlying causes of sore gums can have serious health consequences. For example, gingivitis can progress to periodontitis, advanced gum disease that extends well below the gum line. Periodontitis can be silent and painless. It can remain undetected until the body cannot adapt anymore, and we start seeing symptoms like tooth loss and shifting teeth, says Dr. Thomas Nguyen, an instructor in oral medicine, infection, and immunity at the Harvard School of Dental Medicine. If the gum disease bacteria get into the bloodstream, they can infect the heart valves, which is a life-threatening situation. Various studies have linked periodontitis and some of the bacteria that cause it to high blood pressure, diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, osteoporosis, pneumonia, and even Alzheimer's disease. How an infection of the gums might increase the risk of these very different diseases involving organs a long way from the gums is the subject of speculation and study. In other words, we really don't know. For example, one bacteria that causes gum disease is Porphyriomonas gingivalis, and it's found more often in the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease than the brains of people who don't have Alzheimer's. Growing evidence suggests that P. gingivalis can travel in the blood and cause infection of the brain, which in turn may lead the brain to produce a chemical called beta amyloid to kill the bacteria. Unfortunately, that same chemical also increases the risk of Alzheimer's. The following over-the-counter remedies or treatments may temporarily relieve gum pain. Ibuprofen, also called Advil or Motrin, can help reduce gum pain, but check with your doctor to make sure it won't interfere with your other medications. For example, ibuprofen can increase the risk for internal bleeding. If you're taking a blood thinner like warfarin or dabigatran, which is also called pradaxa, or eliquis. Topical gels. Benzocaine gels that you rub on the gum may relieve pain for a short time. Talk to your dentist or doctor before using the gels. They're associated with a rare but dangerous side effect called methemoglobinemia, which keeps cells from getting oxygen. Better flossing tools. If the sore gum is caused by gingivitis or food that's stuck in your teeth, a water flosser like Waterpik, along with regular flossing and use of interdental brushes, can help by removing bacterial plaque and resolving the inflammation. Compresses. Apply either hot or cold compresses to sore gums. Rinses. Swish warm salt water around your mouth a few times per day. Some people tout herbal remedies like drops of clove oil applied to the gums, but there's little evidence that suggests that this does much, and it could possibly be harmful. Munching dry toast, dry cereals, crackers, or any hard foods can irritate or abrade fragile gums. Avoid foods with rough textures until your gums feel better. How long do you treat it? Dr. Nguyen says gum pain often goes away after a few weeks. For conditions like ulcers, trauma, burns, inflammation, or herpes simplex, time will be your best friend. The body will heal on its own after 14 days, he notes, but if gum pain persists, see your dentist. The next article in the Harvard Health Letter is called, Are You Risking Eye Damage by Putting Off That Eye Care Visit? Early stages of vision-robbing diseases often have no symptoms. Once you reach age 65, you need comprehensive dilated eye exams every 1 or 2 years, more often if you have eye problems. But doctors say the pandemic is keeping some people from getting eye care. Some people are delaying treatment, trying to avoid crowds or health facilities like hospitals. They're not getting their eye pressure checked, and they're not using their eye medications, says Dr. Roberto Pineda, an ophthalmologist and eye surgeon at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. What's the risk? Vision loss usually occurs gradually and painlessly. Most people don't notice until after the damage has been done. Putting off eye care increases the risk for undetected or uncontrolled eye conditions, eye damage, and vision loss, especially from glaucoma. With delayed eye care, we're seeing more severe cases of glaucoma and more people coming to the emergency room with advanced vision loss, says Dr. Lucy Shen, an ophthalmologist who specializes in glaucoma treatment at Massachusetts Eye and Ear. Sometimes the eye pressure changes that damage vision, and glaucoma happen quickly. Two of my patients had worsening glaucoma. Their eye pressures were normal in March. They should have come back in June, but canceled. When they came back in September, they had very high eye pressure and needed surgery, Dr. Shen says. Delayed eye care also allows other eye problems to go unchecked. The following eye conditions have few or minor symptoms at first and may only be detected by eye exams. One of these is an eye stroke. Like the heart or brain, the eye can suffer damage from obstruction of a blood vessel. One type of eye stroke occurs when blood flow leaving the retina, the light-sensing component in the back of the eye, is disrupted. It can cause temporary or permanent vision loss. People with high blood pressure, diabetes, glaucoma, and cardiovascular disease are at greater risk for this condition. Diabetic retinopathy. Diabetes can cause blood vessels in the retina to become leaky, leading to temporary vision loss. Sometimes the blood will clear on its own. If it doesn't, you may need surgery. If the old blood or new blood vessels block the drain in your eye, you can get increased eye pressure and glaucoma, Dr. Shen says. Age-related macular degeneration. This condition gradually destroys the macula, the retina's central portion. It's the part of the eye that provides central vision, needed for seeing objects clearly. Symptoms and intervention. You may not be able to tell if an eye condition has developed or is progressing unless it's advanced and you experience symptoms, which can include blind spots near peripheral or central vision, severe pain in the eye or forehead, severe light sensitivity, blurred or reduced vision, temporary vision loss, headaches along with vision change, eye redness, halos around lights, spots or cobwebs in your field of vision. Check your vision in one eye at a time. If you have symptoms in only one eye, that's a sign of a problem, Dr. Shen says. But don't wait until symptoms occur to see your doctor. Keep your scheduled eye appointments. Your doctor can dilate your pupils and look into the back of your eye to examine the health of the retina. Your eye care team can also check your eye pressure, making sure your eye muscles are functioning properly, and check for vision changes. If necessary, the doctor can prescribe medications, give injections, or perform procedures to halt disease progression. If the eye disease advances, medications will need to be adjusted, or you may need surgery. If you're worried about COVID-19 exposure in the healthcare setting, Dr. Shen suggests calling your doctor's office to talk about it. If you just cancel and don't reschedule, that's when we often see advanced disease. You may find out about precautions. Excuse me. The office is taking to ensure your safety, like disinfecting equipment, wearing masks, screening patients for COVID before arrival, limiting waiting room times, limiting the number of people in waiting rooms and keeping them 6 feet apart, and offering hybrid visits. Well, pardon me for that episode of coughing. Looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks a lot for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I'll see you next time.